Sunday, August 4th, 2013, and this is episode 29 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. So the first thing I want to talk about is in recent weeks, I have been soliciting feedback on the podcast, and as a result, there's two specific changes I'm working on. The first one I'll start now, and that is starting off these podcasts with what essentially is a table of contents of the stories that I'll talk about. And the other is adding a co-host, so it's not just me talking constantly. I'm still working out the details on the co-host. Hopefully I'll have that lined up for next week, but we'll see. So moving on to stories for this week. The stories I'm going to cover this week are first a little bit of trivia around the spelling of the word cybersecurity. Next is some interesting developments in relation to USB security. Next is a renewed look at security controls that should be applied to administrators resulting from the breach of the French web hosting firm OVH. And then the GCHQ and MI5 in the UK have approached the FTSE 350, or basically the top 350 public companies in the UK, about going through essentially a cybersecurity review that will be hosted by GCHQ and MI5. And then finally, I want to talk about black swans for a minute. All right, so the first story is of little consequence, although I find it interesting because I have crossed swords with a number of people at work about this particular topic, and I think it's just kind of interesting to me. So the question is, how do you spell cybersecurity? Is it cyberspace security, cyber-security, or cybersecurity with no space or dash? Not letting this bit of a mystery go to waste, a lady named Cynthia Brumfield has decided to go and chase down the answer. And so there's a blog post written by her where she goes on a quest interviewing different English professors and authorities on the topic. And the net is that it's either cybersecurity with no space or cyberspace security. Cyberspace security appears to be a little more correct than the previous, and that's actually the way I've been spelling it for some time, and I often find myself having to defend that. Okay, the next story is about USB devices. And I find this one interesting because it kind of vindicates some things I've been doing at work for quite some time now. Now, it's pretty well known that you really should disable auto run. So when you insert a USB device in the system, it doesn't try to automatically run whatever malware you have on the USB drive. I think everybody's gotten the message, and even later versions of Windows have it disabled by default, which is really a good thing. But that isn't the end. Basically, the problem is that you still can have a workable attack even with auto run turned off and even without having to rely on somebody sticking the drive in and then navigating and executing some malicious software on the USB drive. The attack works like this. Rather than just having a mass storage device, some clever people figured out that if you stick a microprocessor in the form factor of a USB drive, you can actually emulate a keyboard or a mouse, and that will enable you to auto run some scripts. So basically, this article on ZDNet, which is a rehash of a Webroot blog post, points out that there are commercially available drives that look like a normal USB drive, but when you open it up, it has a spot for a micro SD card, and that micro SD card is the payload that you want to have executed via what essentially is an emulated keyboard. And the advertisement for one of these little devices points out that you can set up a Wi-Fi access point with a firewall disabled. You can execute PowerShell scripts that will download and execute malware of your choosing from the internet. You can retrieve the SAM, and you can change the current Wi-Fi association. And they go on to point out that just because you happen to be using Linux and you think that you're immune to this sort of thing, you're not actually, because emulating a keyboard is cross-platform, and therefore if you have your payload set up in such a way that it's aware of the context of the environment it's running in, presumably you can also own a Linux system in the same way, and possibly even in more fantastic ways, since it's a little more command prompt driven. And my point for bringing this up is that just because you've disabled auto run doesn't mean it's acceptable to relax the position on using questionable USB devices. So it's really still very important to be teaching our people not to pick up USB drives from the parking lot or found in the hallway and sticking them in the computer. Just because we have auto run disabled and we have antivirus and all that stuff doesn't actually mean that we're safe. There's still attack vectors that will work, and it still makes a lot of sense to have the right kinds of controls given the environments you're working with around the use of USB devices. And, you know, I'll tell you, I really don't see how you close the gap on this. So if you let, for instance, if you let people plug in a USB keyboard, it's probably going to be difficult or impossible to actually block this kind of attack unless there's some radical change in the way non-mass storage use USB devices are monitored for certain kinds of activity. So if you're looking for an interesting project to make a name for yourself, here you go. All right, the next story is about a French web hosting firm named OVH, which was compromised a couple of weeks ago. And in the aftermath, the company basically said what happened, and one of their administrators' email accounts was, quote, hacked, and that was in turn used to gain VPN accounts or a VPN account, and that in turn was used to compromise the accounts of a couple of other administrators, which was then used to steal information out of a database. So they don't actually come out and say how the administrator's email account was hacked, but I think it's probably safe to say it was done via a phishing attack. So the person probably got a phishing email and opened an attachment, and that created some kind of a command shell for the attacker to control this person's computer. They then proceeded to obtain a VPN credential. I'm not clear if that was by resetting the password of the compromised PC's account or if there was some other method. But the net impact is that we have a situation where people with elevated privileges are being targeted by attackers. And it's a pretty effective mechanism for attackers to use. I think there's a lot to learn from this, and it's similar to other incidents we've seen with, I believe, the state of South Carolina and some others, where organizations really need to take a look at people who have, again, privileged access to systems really ought to be running with additional controls, right? So they might need to have a separate system for performing their email. You know, we see time and time again, the Syrian Electronic Army has this down to a science. They compromise some PC and they root around till they find the person who has access to the Twitter account, and then they go to town. And organizations really have to take a step back and say, okay, you know, who has access to the data? And given the context of what's happening in the world today, how do we isolate activities and separate activities to minimize the risk so that if something is compromised in somebody's email, it doesn't give them a clean line of sight to download our customer database? And the downside is that, you know, this generally comes at the trade-off of, frankly, ease of use and employee happiness and satisfaction. So if you have to use a different system to check your email than you do to log into the server that you manage, you know, that's a bit of a headache. But, you know, what's the alternative? Unfortunately, we don't really have a fully effective or I'd say even partially effective blinky box or piece of software that's going to keep everything safe. Now in the case of OVH, one thing that probably would have helped dramatically would have been two-factor authentication. And I think if you look back at many of the other organizations that fell victim to similar things, two-factor would have helped. But, you know, realistically, it's not a panacea, because you still have a situation where an attacker has a footprint on a workstation. And so it's not hard to think that they may still be able to, you know, gather enough damning information out of an employee's email or that sort of thing. Possibly application whitelisting would have stopped whatever piece of malware was run out of the employee's email. Again, assuming that was the method of attack, I feel pretty confident that it probably was. You know, possibly application whitelisting would have helped. But again, it's, you know, even that's not a 100% solution. And so it really begs the question, how do you segment workloads, especially in these populations of administrative users, so that you minimize the opportunity for bad guys to take advantage of chinks in the armor to get to your crown jewels? And ultimately, that becomes a business decision, because nothing is free. And so if you implement additional controls, it's going to cost money in terms of equipment, software, infrastructure, and employee satisfaction, most likely, and employee productivity. And so you have to put that into a balance and figure out how does it make sense, or what makes sense given the exposure of your company. And I would also say, this is something that bothers me a lot about IT people, and that's that IT people tend to overestimate their ability to not fall victim to the same kinds of attacks that the average stupid user might fall victim to. But, you know, my experience having run IT for quite some time, it's simply not the case. And that false sense of security people have will often create some significant problems, because, you know, again, it lets the guard down. You don't think about implementing controls around your elite IT people. You think about putting them around the non-privileged masses of user population, because, you know, these IT people who live on privileged networks and have administrative access, they know what they're doing. They're not going to fall victim to the phishing attack. They're not going to stick the USB drive they found in the parking lot into their computer. But in reality, they're still people, and social engineering generally still works. All right, the next story is out of the UK, and this is the MI5 and GCHQ, which are the intelligence agencies in the UK, are calling for the FTSE 350 to perform a cyber health check. And that's their words, not mine. Essentially, this is initially going to be sending a questionnaire to the CEO of the company and the chairman of the audit committee of the company, and asking them to rate different things related to security, and that would in turn feed into some subsequent risk mitigation activities. And apparently the genesis of this is that, surprisingly, the UK government has decided that, number one, about 80% or more of UK companies are reporting incidents of data theft, and the other is that that sort of thing creates a drag on the economy and therefore is something of a national security problem. Now, I think this is actually kind of an interesting idea, especially since it targets the top of the company, and I think it will likely have the effect of getting management a lot more involved in what the risks are, and so maybe that helps to drive prioritization, which ultimately drives down that 80% number of 80% of companies having a data breach. You know, potentially the only really interesting thing to me was the organizations that are calling for this being MI5 and GCHQ. It would be very similar to, say, the CIA or the NSA and the FBI calling for this kind of a thing in the United States. And I would expect that wouldn't go over very well with the population at large. But again, it seems like an interesting idea, probably not a lot of downside to it. We'll see where it goes. Hopefully, as this idea progresses, we'll hear more about it, and possibly companies beyond the UK can take advantage of the idea here. And the last story for tonight is about the Black Swan. So I've mentioned a bunch of times in the past that I've become a lot more interested in statistics as it relates to information security, and becoming more quantitative and less qualitative in our assessment and prioritization of risks and things that need to be done. So there's an interesting concept running around, and it kind of flares up like shark attacks, I suppose, and that's the concept of the black swan. And I will assume that most people already know what a black swan is, but if you don't, it's basically an event that is unexpected, has a giant impact, but in retrospect seems quite predictable. So this blog post I reference, exploringpossibilityspace.blogspot.com, is run by a guy named Russell Cameron Thomas, and he kind of decomposes the problems with the black swan concept. And, you know, basically it is an affront to probabilistic methods, and, you know, it essentially says that there are just some things that we can't predict. And the key messages in the blog post here are quite interesting in that just because you can't predict it or I can't predict it doesn't mean that it isn't predictable. And the other is that the term black swan is being horribly misused and used in many, many different venues. And so, you know, he points out that in one case, there's somebody referring to the persistent theft of login IDs and passwords from just websites in general as black swan events. And I don't know, to me, it seems like once it's happened 10 or 20 or 30 times, you probably can't call it a black swan event anymore because, well, you know, they're happening all over the place. But even aside from that, if you look at some of the other more contemporary and what are considered to be more significant and accepted black swan events, you know, the stock market crash and the financial crash of 2008 is one. The September 11th attacks are another. The Stuxnet worm, and on, because they had huge impacts. In retrospect, they seem like they should have been predictable, but they weren't predicted. And the problem is that they weren't predicted by the people who are thinking about it. They were definitely predicted by some people. I mean, in the case of Stuxnet, I mean, it was developed by, you know, by our military here in the U.S., to take out the uranium processing capabilities of Iran. You know, anybody who was paying attention had to know that there was going to be some kind of effort undertaken to prevent that from happening. I guess, you know, maybe the one thing that was a bit of a surprise is that it leaked outside the borders of the Natanz facility. But even that, I don't think is that big of a stretch. So, you know, can you sit back and have on your spreadsheet of risks a cyber war, cyber weapon being accidentally released into the wild? And did you have that on your list previously? Well, probably not. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a black swan and unpredictable. It just means that for those people who saw it as a black swan, their aperture wasn't open enough. You know, there are people thinking about this sort of thing. Just because I don't think it is statistically predictable doesn't mean that it is a black swan. It just means that I don't have an adequate set of input. And so, you know, from that perspective, I think the term black swan is very relative because it's really dependent on the perspective of the viewer, right? So, you know, it's similar to general relativity. Whether or not something is a black swan is entirely dependent on your frame of reference and what inputs and knowledge you happen to have. So it's a really, really great article. I would definitely encourage you to read it. And also, if you're not thinking about information security in the perspective of probabilities, you know, take a look at that. Go ahead and read the books I've previously recommended, the How to Measure Anything and The Failure of Risk Management. Both are by a guy named Douglas Hubbard. They're relatively inexpensive. They're pretty short reads, but they're very, very good, and I think they will definitely change how you think about information security and prioritization and in particular black swans. You know, you may still end up thinking that the entire idea is crap, but at least you'll have the background and be able to speak the lingo. Well, that's all I have time for this week, and I look forward to talking to you again next week with some new and exciting stories. In the meantime, you can find defensive security on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. You'll find a way to subscribe to the podcast there. You can find the show notes, which has links to all the stories that I talked about. You can find some other resources that I have been curating, like other podcasts, which I listen to and recommend. This podcast is definitely not the end-all be-all. There's much more detail and entertaining podcasts out there, so give that a look. I'm going to be adding a section on recommended books because I have been reading quite a lot, and there's a lot of really good books out there. You can find the show on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter at MaliciousLink. And if you have any feedback, ideas, suggestions, questions about the topics I've talked about, send an email to info@defensivesecurity.org, or you can send me a tweet on Twitter, and I definitely enjoy hearing from listeners and getting ideas on how to improve or new things to talk about. So with that, I will talk to you all again next week, and I hope you have a great week. Bye.